Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks. Welcome, Sharkies. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Sharkpedia.
We're so excited to have you guys.
Yeah, we're so excited to have everyone back. And not only are we excited to have you here, but we have a special guest today. We have PhD candidate Alex McInturf from UC Davis. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to see this podcast get off the ground.
Yeah, we are too.
We're excited to talk to you on our podcast.
Yeah, we definitely are. So before we get too far into it, I just introduced you as a PhD candidate. And so before we even introduce what you're doing and what we're going to talk about today, let's just briefly touch base. What's the difference between a PhD student and a candidate? Because I actually didn't know this until about 6 months ago.
I didn't know this until like 6 weeks ago. So
I only knew this when I started grad school. So this is like certainly not common knowledge. And I will say, I think a lot of the reason that people call themselves PhD candidates is because it takes a lot to get to that point. So it's kind of like a merit badge. So when you start grad school, you start off as a PhD student, right? You're enrolled in a program, which is awesome. But to advance to candidacy, to become a PhD candidate, you usually have to do some sort of scary obstacle, like a qualifying exam, in which you sit in front of a committee of faculty and present your proposed research for 3 hours and answer questions about it, which is obviously very strenuous. So I'm sure you can understand that once you pass that, you do want to be called a candidate.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's different from defending your PhD, right?
Correct. Yes. So certain programs vary in what they expect from their students, but defending your PhD usually happens at the very end. So the qualifying exam and advancing to candidacy happens much earlier in your PhD career.
I feel like you definitely deserve the ability to call yourself a PhD candidate after standing in front of a bunch of people and defending your entire project for a very long time and probably getting questions that may not even pertain to your project that you then need to know the answers to anyway.
Yeah, right. I know, I actually, it's funny because when I first got into my grad program before the quarter even started, I actually had on my Twitter, I was also new to Twitter, and I said I was a PhD candidate. And then someone was like, aren't you a first year? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, but you said you're a candidate. And I'm like, well, yeah, of course I'm a candidate. I made it into the program. Of course I'm a candidate to be a PhD. Like,
I did that too. I made a signature that said PhD candidate. No one corrected me. I had to find out awkwardly by looking at other people.
Oh my God. No.
I feel like that's even worse. No, a couple people did me a solid and they told me pretty quickly, like, hey, just FYI, I think you're mislabeling yourself. And I was like, ooh, thanks.
Now all the people who listen to the podcast can learn from our mistakes and just go with PhD student instead of candidate and having to deal with the awkward email that's like, you're not a candidate.
Yeah. I mean, also, let's be real. There's just so many hurdles to get through a PhD. So when PhD people tell you about something, maybe listen to them a little bit because they had to go through a lot of things to get that PhD and have certainly earned it for sure.
Absolutely. Throw the doctor in front of there. They deserve it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, awesome. So today we're going to be doing a few things, but Alex, before we get super into it, can you just explain what you do for part of your research as a PhD candidate?
Sure, I'm happy to. So I will say my PhD journey has certainly not been straight. It's taken a lot of turns along the way, and I think that's super normal. But now I generally say that I study how the environment affects organism, movement, behavior, and physiology. So basically, I look at how certain components of the environment, like temperature or current, in the marine environment specifically, affects how animals move, how they interact with each other, and how it affects actually what's going on inside their bodies as well.
Oh, that's awesome. I have so many questions for you already.
But my head is buzzing. Yeah. Too many things going on in my mind.
Before we break those down, are there certain species that you look at with all those things, with the environment and their physiology?
Sure, absolutely. So I tend to study threatened marine organisms. So animals underwater that are facing certain threats, largely due to humans, but also due to like climate change. And so I love studying sharks, which is why I'm on this podcast. I'm a total shark head. So a lot of my field work has taken place in Ireland studying basking sharks. I'm part of the Irish basking shark group. I also study basking sharks here in California. But of course, you can't really bring a basking shark into the lab.
Really? Why not? You can't throw a giant fish in your lab?
Trust me, I would have totally figured out a way if it was possible.
Just like crane their whole body up in like this giant tank and relocate it.
Oh, totally. You need like something that can carry a small school bus to do that. Yes.
Listen, I think we can make it work. I think between the three of us, we could figure it out.
Well, that's awesome. That's perfect that you study basking sharks, because we as a group decided to go over an article that we're going to digest and reinterpret for our listeners today. And that article is called "Are Close Following and Breaching Behaviors by Basking Sharks at Aggregation Sites Related to Courtship?" That article was written by Gore, Abels, Wozzeck, Sadler, and Ormond, and that was based in the Western Islands of Scotland. And Alex, you said you study them in Ireland, is that right?
I do, yes.
Where else can you find them? Because I only very recently learned that they might also be off the coast of California, is that true?
That is true. Actually, I'm working on a paper right now examining trends in basking shark distribution, so where they're found along the California coast.
I'm shook. I'm shook.
I'm happy to talk about that. But basically, you can find basking sharks worldwide. So they historically have been thought to be in cooler waters, so like further north, particularly in the northern hemisphere, although also down in New Zealand. But some recent papers have shown that they're also capable of like crossing the equator and going down to Brazil or the coast of Africa. So they're kind of global citizens. They move everywhere.
Oh, that's amazing.
I feel like their physiology and like metabolism has to be crazy to go across that temperature gradient that you're going through if you're going from like way up down past the equator. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's actually funny that you say that, because basking sharks have been found at a ton of different temperatures, ranging from like 8 degrees Celsius to 24, which, you know, sharks, so I study a lot of physiology too. Sharks are generally ectothermic, which means that they rely on their environment to regulate their body temperature. So they can't kind of keep themselves cold or warm. They have to basically move to an environment that is cold or warm. But some sharks are partly endothermic, which means that they can regulate their own internal body temperature. And among those are great white sharks. And related to great white sharks are basking sharks. So,
oh my gosh.
There is some speculation, although this is yet to be proven in any way, that they might be able to potentially regulate their internal body temperature. Although currently we think that they are ectothermic. That needs to be further examined.
Oh my gosh, I'm learning so much.
My brain just exploded, I think.
You guys, I mean, we're all shark scientists, but we don't get to like listen to other people talk about sharks all the time. So getting to listen to this is just still mind-blowing, because I never talked to anybody about basking sharks. This is so cool.
There are temperature-changing queens of the ocean, I've decided. That's what I'm calling them. Because also, they're herbivores, right? They eat... What are they?
Okay, so basking sharks, just to back up a little bit, are the world's second largest fish. So they can grow to almost 30 feet long, although they tend to be smaller, like on the side of like 20 feet long nowadays, which is, you know, comparatively smaller, but still the size of a small school bus.
Wow.
But they, like the other largest fish in the ocean, eat plankton. So we call them planktivores.
And the first largest fish is a whale shark, I'm assuming?
Correct. So there's only three planktivorous sharks It's only three sharks that eat plankton in the world, and they are the three largest. So you have your whale shark, your basking shark, and your megamouth shark.
What is it with filter feeding animals that are so, so large? Like those three sharks and then whales. Whales also eat plankton.
Yeah. And they're so large in comparison to any other like carnivorous or omnivorous sharks.
To literally anything. They're like the aren't whales and sharks like the largest species on Earth?
Unless there's
right
a dinosaur that we don't know about.
Oh, they're definitely.
Yeah. It's really interesting that you say that. So there's a lot of work being done on like gigantism, essentially. That's the term for these animals reaching these really big sizes. And there's a lot that, you know, a lot of environmental constraints, a lot of metabolism, what's going on inside their bodies. But also think about it, like a lot of what we see on land are these large herbivores. We see like cows and giraffes and elephants. And if you think about it, there's so much plankton in the ocean. These sharks have a constantly renewing food source. Right? Mm. It doesn't take very long for plankton to become very abundant, right? So they're just these tiny little particles of, you know, plants, which are phytoplankton, and tiny particles of animals, or tiny, not particles, but tiny animals called zooplankton. And it doesn't take very long for them to grow. So they're often sometimes even the juveniles of other fish. And so you constantly have this food source available. These sharks can filter feed all day if they wanted to. And so I think that does definitely contribute to size.
They live in their own personal grocery store that restocks itself by the second.
Oh my gosh.
Exactly.
That makes total sense. I just never thought about it that way. Oh, that's so cool. Okay, well, thank you so much. And then the last couple questions I have before we dive into this article is, you said that you study some other species like salmon. Do salmon have similar physiology capabilities that you're studying in basking sharks? And then just to clarify for our listeners, can we talk about what is physiology? Because a lot of people listening might not actually even know what that word means.
Totally. Happy to define physiology. And I'm actually relatively new to this field. So I also want all the listeners to know that, you know, scientists study these things because they're really interesting. That doesn't necessarily mean we're not always learning. So absolutely. I started studying. Yeah, I think that's really important. And it's not something I thought of when I started my PhD. So physiology is essentially the study of how an animal's body works. You know, it's metabolism, cellular mechanisms that are going on inside the body. And what I do is I'm really interested in temperature, as you can probably tell from the basking shark conversation. So I'm interested in studying particularly ectothermic fish. So fish, again, that rely on their environment to maintain their body temperature. And what's really interesting about ectotherms, that's what we call them, is that they often have an optimal temperature that they can operate at. So the way I like to think of this is, you know, I played soccer growing up, and you warm up before a game so that you're firing on all cylinders, your body's ready to go, your fast twitch muscles are working really well.
All those stretches. All the stretches. It's like a half hour of stretching for soccer.
Exactly. It's so much stretching. And at the time I was all like grown up, I was young and spry. And I was like, I don't get it. Now I get it. And I get it in the context of fish. So basically ectothermic fish, they have to go to certain areas to find their optimal temperature. They can't just warm themselves up like we do for soccer. They have to go to an environment where the temperature is optimal for their body. And that optimal temperature has happened and determined over thousands of years and millions of years of evolution, depending on the species. So, for example, salmon tend to occupy cooler habitats. And so what I'm studying is, okay, what happens when the waters warm up? Is it salmon physiology? How is it adapting? Are they able to function as well? And specifically, I'm interested in, okay, how susceptible or how vulnerable do they then become to predation if their bodies are not operating as well at warmer temperatures? Mm. So that's one of the studies that I'm working on.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I was thinking because, I mean, the other thing about salmon is even though they're in colder climates, they're changing, they're anadromous fish, which means they're going from freshwater to saltwater and then back to freshwater when they go to spawn. So they must also have like crazy physiological adaptations that allow them to go from those environments. But also I would imagine temperatures fluctuating quite a lot, right? Because in the ocean, the ocean theoretically is a lot more stable than something like a river habitat, right?
Absolutely. And it's actually really interesting that you say that, because the prevailing wisdom is that salmon are cold water fish. And what we're doing when we do these physiology experiments in the lab, and basically that entails running them on a fish treadmill for, you know, at certain temperatures, and then also putting them into burst tunnels so that we make them sprint back and forth.
What is a fish treadmill? Because I feel like nobody knows what a fish treadmill is, and I mostly just imagined a fish running on a treadmill, and they don't have legs. So I know that that's not what a fish treadmill is.
Sorry. Yes, we call, so they're called swim tunnels. And it's essentially you put them in a little chamber and then you flow water against them at certain speeds. And your goal is to exhaust them. So see, you know, how quickly they get exhausted at certain temperatures. At what temperatures do we exhaust them? But they're maximizing their oxygen intake. We study all these things in the lab. It's very technical. But I like to talk about fish treadmills because I think it's a cool visual.
Oh, me too. It totally makes sense. And you're measuring their oxygen at the same time, right? So you have like a probe in there that as they're swimming at a certain temperature, you can measure how much oxygen they're consuming. Yeah, that's super cool. That's actually a pretty common physiology study. And like we were talking about earlier, if you get a basking shark in a treadmill like that, that'd be so interesting. There's so much we could learn if we could put large animals on a fish treadmill.
World's biggest treadmill. Someone would need to just like take a bus, take all the inside of it out, and then somehow make it a flow tank.
Yeah. Which one of our listeners wants to build that for us?
That'd yeah, be great. Someone sign up, please.
That's awesome. Okay, that's so great. Thank you so much for breaking that down. I think that gives us a really good background, especially before we start jumping into this article about basking sharks. Amani, you have a summary for us. Do you mind summarizing what this article is about before we start asking all of our questions to Alex about basking sharks?
Totally. So basically, I'm just going to read the summary and then we're just going to chat about all the crazy things in this paper and hopefully break it down for you guys, because even for us reading a paper as scientists, it's not always easy for us to understand what a scientific paper is saying. And so we're hoping that with this summary and with our talking, this paper will be a lot more understandable to you as a non-scientist or even as another scientist. So basically, this paper looked at the possibility that certain aggregations of basking sharks are a pre-mating behavior. So they expected that directed movements of one basking shark towards another would be related to courtship, but eventually found that it wasn't. They determined that, quote, individuals show close following chiefly for feeding-related hydrodynamic behavior, unquote, and that while their study did not prove anything, it is still possible that mature basking sharks may use feeding aggregations to initiate pre-courtship behavior. So basically, we'll talk about all these crazy methods that they used, but in summary of the giant paragraph that I just said to you, they thought that aggregations were going to be a pre-courtship behavior, but found that one, that couldn't be proven, and while it might still be a possibility, there are many other reasons why they might aggregate in the way that they do.
Right, because Alex, correct me if I'm wrong, but basking sharks typically would be solitary animals, right? They're typically by themselves alone, but it looks like they sometimes aggregate together. You're smiling, so I
yeah, I saw that. She was
say.
Like, oh, I got some stuff to tell you guys.
So here's what I'm here to tell your listeners. Sharks can be social. And I think that a lot of times when we think about Jaws, we think about this scary, individual, mindless, man-eating machine, right? And I think that leads to a lot of misconception and a lot of unfortunate actions on behalf of policymakers and even members of the general public. It's really just a misunderstanding. And so one of the things I am interested in is examining social behavior in sharks. And I think it's really important in understanding that sharks can not only recognize other sharks, but they can prefer to be with certain sharks.
We sharks call that have preferential friends. Assortment.
Sharks have friends. That's what I'm here to say today. So basking sharks are a really interesting case for a variety of reasons. They're really hard to study, right? They're huge. They travel all over the world. But at certain times of year, they do come into coastal areas like Western Scotland, where they gather in what we call aggregations. And that's just a fancy word for big groups. So when we're talking about aggregations in this paper, we're talking about these big groups forming. And for a long time, people have been saying, well, they must come together because we think they're otherwise solitary. They must come together to mate.
Right.
Mating has never been observed in basking sharks, not in these aggregations. And it's important to note that when they're in these aggregations, they're at the surface, which is why Gore et al. In this paper were able to see them. And so if they were mating, it's probably happening deep underwater and we have not observed it. So that, to start, I think makes me very skeptical that this is just about mating. Right. And Gore found that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. This article is so interesting. We have a lot of questions about it, but that's super helpful. And a lot of, one of the things I want to clarify too, is that it looks like from this article, not all of the aggregations were very many, sometimes just two basking sharks, right?
Yes. And that's very common. And I will say, so there's been a lot of information on basking sharks grouping. They group off the coast of Cape Cod. I think in the early 2000s, they saw like a super group of over 1,000 individuals.
No way.
Yep. And then that happened. It's so many. That's why it was called a super group. It was a group of groups.
That's crazy. But they have... Megan's jaw is open for all you people who can't see that.
I just, to like see that many sharks in one place, I just truly like that would just be... I just could die happy at that speechless. Point, to be honest. I'm speechless. Like, I had no idea. I had no idea.
So that's rare. I will say that's really unusual. And unfortunately, I want to add this important aside that this grouping behavior has contributed to overexploitation. So essentially overfishing of sharks in these coastal areas. And I think it's really important that we don't lay blame on anyone for this. Often these fishing practices were happening at times when folks needed to rely, local communities needed to rely on sharks for things like the oil in their liver to light lamps, for example.
Right.
Unfortunately, though, the sharks didn't seem to recover from these overfishing expeditions that were essentially happening in the middle of the 20th century. And this happened in Ireland, this happened in California, it happened in Scotland a little bit, Norway, it's happened everywhere essentially throughout the basking shark range. And so what we're seeing is not only a decline in the number of sharks sighted in many of these places, but also a decline in the group size, which is really interesting and potentially related.
Oh, so interesting. Yeah, and part of why my jaw was dropping was because I also, again, I still didn't know, I just learned that they're off the coast of California. So to learn that there you could see that many on the east coast of the United States, that's just so mind-blowing. But so interesting that you think the group sizes might be changing too. And one of the things that I wanted to ask about, one of the things they talk a lot about in this article is they do something called echoline swimming. I don't think I'm saying that correctly. It's spelled E-C-H-E-L-O-N. How do you pronounce that?
I would say echelon.
Echelon.
Okay. Wow, we'd all say it different. I was in my mind when I was reading the paper. I was like, oh yeah, echelon.
I was saying, yeah, echelon.
I could be wrong. That's just how I would say it. And I've only heard one or two other people say it before. So who knows?
I'm going to trust the people that have said it before that probably know more about it than I know because I only learned about it from this article.
Disclaimer, all three of us could be wrong.
Right. Disclaimer, for sure. But one of the things that they were talking about in this article is that they do a lot of this echelon swimming, which means there's one leader that's swimming and then there's another one that's not directly behind them, as in like tail to nose of the next animal, but the animal's actually off to the side. Still behind them, but kind of off to their side, like their flank. So they're swimming almost next to each other, but one is much more behind than the other, which I thought was super, super interesting. And I had so many theories going through my head as I was reading this article. And thankfully, this article actually touched on almost all of them.
They did. I also found it super interesting that in their analysis, they found that more of them flanked on the left side than the right side, which I was like, these sharks know direction? Like, why are you choosing the left side over the right side? And then on top of that, the fact that it wasn't always like male, female, like male leading, female trailing, or female leading, male trailing. Sometimes it was two females, sometimes it was male in front, female behind. I just thought that was super interesting because I feel like in terms of like social structure and cues, like those could be very different across those three different options of grouping.
Alex is smiling again. What do you have to say?
No, I love this because these are the questions I think about quite a lot. And I will tell you, a lot of the theories out there are just that. They're just theories, right? We can't bring them into the lab and manipulate them in any experimental way. But I think for a long time, so this echelon swimming, this nose to tail following behavior, which the paper also talks about, where they're literally swimming nose to tail, that's very commonly reported when sharks are in these big groups, these aggregations. And for a long time, people have said, oh, it's courtship, which just means that behavior they exhibit before they mate. So it's kind of like flirting, essentially.
Right.
So
ooh, you look good from the left side. I had to, sorry.
That's amazing. No, so I think it's really interesting, right? I think that everything that they've touched on this paper, we don't really know why they're doing it. But what I like about this paper is they kind of reject this notion that it is courtship. They say, you know, females are following males, males are following females, females are following females. And I think that that really is interesting and contributes to my suspicion that these groups are more than just about mating. Mm-hmm. And I think that for studying social behavior in sharks, this is kind of the stuff we're looking for. This is good evidence of that.
Right. And I also want to touch base before we get too much further is that one of the reasons they thought this was mating behavior was also because of markings that they were seeing physically on the animal in two different locations. One on the nose, and so they thought that males were bumping females, and so they thought that if they identified males, they would see a higher association with this like rub wound on males, for males basically bumping and doing like a flirting behavior with females.
Eskimo
to say, hey.
Kiss.
Exactly, like an Eskimo kiss. The other thing that they predicted, which we see in almost all shark species, I don't actually know of a shark species we don't see this in, but there's mating markings that you often see in females during breeding season. That is because, let's get real, maybe this is a moment when you want to turn off or turn down your volume if kids are in the room. When they need to mate, when sharks need to mate, they don't have hands. And that gets a little bit harder to mate if you don't have hands, right? And so males will actually physically grab the female by their pectoral fin or the side of their body and bite with their mouth because their mouth is the only thing they have to grab onto the female. And that allows them to kind of bend their body, the male's body, around the female's body so that they can actually copulate and successfully mate. So when it's breeding season with lots of different shark species, you see kind of gruesome markings all over the female's body, particularly at her pec fins and the sides of her body and even her tail, as those males are just trying to physically bite and grab those females. And side note and fun fact, female sharks have physically thicker skin on the sides of their body to endure male biting. And if that is not an analogy for what women have to put up with, I don't know what is. I don't know what is.
But listen, that evolutionary trait is 12 out of 10, in my opinion.
I swear, human females must also have thicker skin, like physically. But that's what they expected to see, was that they expected to see the males to have these nose abrasions and they expected to see females with these mating abrasions in association with these aggregations. But based on their findings from this article, that's actually not what they found.
Yeah, another thing I think is interesting, this is a fun fact about basking sharks. So they are filter feeders, right? So basically they filter water through their gills and, you know, eat that way. But they do technically have tiny teeth. They have very tiny teeth in their mouths, which most people wouldn't expect for filter feeding sharks. And so for a long time, people were like, well, why is this the case? They clearly don't need these teeth, unless they do, right? Unless it potentially has a mating purpose. It could just be maybe an evolutionary trait that never really went away, but it also could very easily serve a mating purpose.
I mean, that would make sense because in the article they did say they saw some females with more pectoral kind of abrasions, right? So that's super cool.
Since we're talking about markings, I do think it would be really cool to talk about how you actually ID a shark, especially for this study, because their methods were really cool. And part of coming up with your methods and then writing a paper is also talking about where your methods might fall short. And addressing that and trying to figure out how to get around an obstacle like that. And I feel like most people, when they look at a shark, they like can't tell the difference if it's the same species. And so like, how do we go around IDing sharks that one, we can't throw in a tank or capture, and two, that like we're using drones to see, and also in water snorkelers and also film? Like, how do you tell the difference between all these different sharks?
Yeah. And I think what they found here was that, and this is very common in large shark species, but you can use like coloration on the fins, for example, fin scarring, that's the most common. And I think for basking sharks, especially the Irish basking shark group and others keep sort of fin databases. And it's really easy for the general public and community scientists to also participate in those sorts of endeavors. If they're out on a boat and they happen to see a fin, they can submit those. So I think that's very common. Of course, ideally you'd be able to get a visual ID tag on them that, you know, tells you what the shark is doing and where it is. But those are really hard to deploy on basking sharks, even right. when they're at the surface. So I think the fin was the primary method here, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, one of my questions for you was, are there not tagging of basking sharks? Like, you definitely couldn't just like put a basking shark on the deck or side of your boat, could you?
Right. No, so that's a really good question. Tagging basking sharks is hard for a variety of reasons. The first is that you have to find them. And that I can attest to from my PhD is extraordinarily challenging. Basking sharks are extremely unpredictable. They tend to occupy these coastal areas at certain times of year, but you'd never know how many you're going to get. And in California, at least, they've kind of ceased to show up. So we used to have thousands of individuals here, and now we have maybe one or two reported a season. So wow. That sort of like variation though has been happening for a long time, maybe not to this extreme, but it's been happening for a while. Like even in the 1800s, there were these booms and busts of sharks. And I call the bust kind of shark droughts where you don't really see any for a while. But when you do see them, you can't pull them alongside your boat. You can't bring them on board. Obviously they're bigger than your boat in most cases. So what we do is we go out in a very small boat that gets us close to the water. And you can tag them with a pole from the boat.
Okay. I've tagged sharks. I use a scalpel and I insert that by hand. How do you tag with a pole?
Sure. So that is certainly a viable option for a smaller species to surgically implant tags, right? You can't do that for a basking shark, but they do have very thick skin, as we were talking about before. And so essentially what you do is you kind of dart them, you attach the tag to like a little tether, and it basically has a little dart at the end of it, and you poke it into the skin just below the dorsal fin. It doesn't hurt them. It's like an earring, right? Their skeletons are made of cartilage, but that is primarily the way that we can get these tags on. Now, if we want to put cameras on, we will often try to clamp them on at the front of the dorsal fin. And that is really hard to do, but it's doable. So we do actually have footage from 3 basking sharks from that, from those methods.
And you clamp the camera like on the side of your boat? Are you snorkeling?
No, so you are doing it with a pole from the
with
boat.
With a pole.
You're leaning over the side of the boat. You're playing darts. You're leaning over the side of the boat. You essentially have a long pole extended in front of the dorsal fin, and it has a clamp at the end that releases the camera that is clamped to the fin.
Okay, my jaw's dropped again because I know how hard that is. That is so hard.
Do the cameras stay on like the shark forever, or do they detach after a certain amount of time and then you have to go needle in a haystack, find it in the ocean wherever it's floating?
That is, so we do not want to keep these on the animals long term, right? For their welfare, to make sure that we're not affecting their behavior in a really poor way or affecting their fitness, reproduction. We do time these tags, especially the ones clamped to the fins, to release after a certain period of time. So essentially there's a little lever on them that is holding the device together, and that kind of corrodes or disintegrates after a certain amount of time. And then the whole device just pops off the shark, is attached to a float, and it floats to the surface. And then it is a needle in a haystack, which is always a lot of fun. But we actually, in Ireland, we have had a lot of success with the public or beachgoers actually finding tags washed up on shore. So that's been pretty awesome.
That's so cool. Something that I want to briefly add is, especially when we're talking about tagging and, you know, like Megan said, using a scalpel to like cut open their skin, stick something in and then suture it up, or sticking it right below their dorsal fin, is to remember that we as humans have a tendency to apply human traits to non-human things. And so for any sort of research like this, tons of research has gone into it to make sure that the locations that we're putting these tags are not harmful to the shark in any way. And sharks actually heal incredibly fast. For example, for the research that I've participated in, if you take a muscle biopsy, which is you literally like go into their skin, take muscle out, when you recapture that shark 2 weeks later, there is no scar whatsoever. You can't even tell that we did it 2 weeks prior to that. And on top of that, there's no reaction to them. Like if you pinched me, I would react. But for these sharks, if you, you know, stab them to get the tag in them, they're not reacting to it. Like it basically has no, elicits no response from them in the way that it would us.
Right. I actually, there is a scientific reason for that that I just learned. And for some background, in my master's degree, I studied pain in cephalopods. Now pain, I don't want to dive too deep into this, but pain is relative based on individual. But the reason that animals can perceive pain is through something called nociceptors, which are cells in our skin that can detect harmful or potentially harmful stimulus. So that allows an animal to respond to trauma, and especially over time. So like if you have a paper cut, you can feel that paper cut for days later because you have nociceptors that are telling you there's a paper cut in my hand right now and I'm still feeling it and it still hurts. Cephalopods have nociceptors. I just learned sharks actually lack nociceptors. They don't have any nociceptors that we've been able to find.
What?
Yeah, your guys, yeah.
What?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So this is honestly makes total evolutionary sense because I have literally seen sharks swimming with major injuries before. And they swim around like nothing is wrong with them. And that's very likely because they lack nociceptors. So they are not experiencing a constant stimulus that's saying, you have an injury, you have an injury, you have an injury, like we have. They don't have that. So there's actually scientific reasoning of why when you want to implant a tag or something like that, they don't necessarily respond. Now, they do have nerves. They can feel things in general. So if you hit a nerve, then yeah, sure, they're going to flex and respond to that. But they don't have nociceptors that are constantly telling them, I'm in pain, this is painful. So yeah, you're totally right.
Super cool.
That is so cool.
We're all just shook. Do we need a moment to like digest this information that was just given to us?
That is definitely one of my favorite facts I've been wanting to tell people recently, is this fact that they don't have nociceptors. It's just so crazy. But let's get back to the paper and talk about something that they talked about a lot in this paper, which is that basking sharks breach. So what's the deal? Can you just break it down for us? Like, what's the deal with breaching? And then we can kind of break down the theories that they had and some of the theories that I thought about too.
And please remind us how large these sharks are so that we can understand the craziness of this breaching, which they don't get enough credit for. We don't give the whales enough credit for launching their giant bus-sized bodies out of the water.
That takes a lot of energy.
It does. It takes a ton of energy. And so we have also seen it in sharks. Right? We've seen it with air jaws. I'm sure many folks have seen air jaws where the great white sharks are ambushing their prey from below and launching themselves out of the water. That makes a lot of sense, right? It's energetically costly to do that. You're experiencing a lot of drag from the pressure of the water as you're thrusting yourself up into the water column. But for white sharks, it's worth it, right? They're going to get a very tasty snack to maybe offset that energetic cost. So the question is, why the heck are basking sharks, which feed on plankton, breaching, right? It's clearly not a feeding problem. So people are still trying to address this question. And what I'm going to talk about now is just my experience with it and also what the prevailing theories are, which Gore et al. Also touch on. The first theory is that maybe it's some sort of social signal, right? And that's, again, gets at this idea of social behavior. So maybe they're indicating what their body size is based on the sound of the slap to other sharks that are around. Another theory is that perhaps they're getting rid of parasites or like lampreys, which are basically these organisms that attach themselves to the basking shark and hitch a ride. So those are the two competing hypotheses right now, and they certainly don't have to be mutually exclusive. But what I will say is my most favorite experience with basking sharks actually involves breaching. So I will say I've spent 3 summers in Ireland and I've only seen sharks once.
Okay. Oh, no.
This is why my PhD took a different track, but I think that is interesting in itself. And I am happy to talk about my theories behind that. But the one time I did see them, they were breaching and it was so cool. So essentially we were out on the water and I was with other members of the Irish Basking Shark Group. It was my first summer in Ireland and we were going in at 4 p.m. We were all along the very northernmost coast of Ireland and it was, you know, the day was winding down, the sun was kind of lower in the sky, and all of a sudden we heard this like gunshot. That's what it sounded like. It was extremely loud. And for a long time, you know, my collaborators were saying, oh, look, there's one. Oh, look, there's one. And it got to a point where I couldn't see them because I just like couldn't, you know, visualize what was going on and I had no idea what to look for. So I started calling them the leprechaun sharks. And I said, you guys are pulling my leg. They're not actually breaching. But then I saw it and they are so cool when they breach. There was one super close to our boat. We saw about 30 breaches in the span of 2 hours.
No way.
Flying very sharks. Very cool.
How many individuals do you think were breaching next to you in that time?
It's hard to say, certainly. And I think this paper also does talk about the frequency of breaching in groups, but you would see one roughly a football field away from the boat and then one almost right at the same time right next to the boat breaching. So there were certainly multiple individuals in an area, but we didn't see them at the surface at all. So I actually have no estimate for how many were actually there, but it was very, very cool.
Yeah, and also this paper does touch on the fact that they noticed that one shark would breach multiple times, even sometimes like in a row, which is crazy because that must take so much energy, one, to like launch yourself out of the water and then to repeatedly do it. And like for fun, question mark? Like, is it just enjoyable to them or what is the advantage?
Right. Another really interesting thing, there was a paper that came out from my same collaborators, actually, from one of the cameras that they had deployed on the shark. They caught a breach on camera. They actually were able to calculate based on the tail beats what its rough velocity or speed was as it was breaching. And it reached speeds that were similar to what great white sharks reach when they are also breaching.
Just laughing at the insanity.
That's amazing.
Yes, I mean, so cool.
I think the thing that I want our listeners to really understand is that we're comparing like this apex predator shark that's an ambush predator, that's body is literally built for ambush predation, like meaning they're built for speed, they're built for like attacking at high speeds. And yet a basking shark that filter feeds gracefully, slowly, majestically is somehow reaching the same speeds as the top predatory shark in the ocean as it's breaching.
It's crazy. Basking sharks are like, I am slow shark until I decide to breach, then I zip zoom.
Can we make a sweatshirt that says that?
Yes. Or like a wrap where they're like, what's up? I'm a basking shark and I'm slow. But then when I decide to zip zoom, I launch my body and I'm better than a great white. I can't rap at all. But I think that should be a song and someone who does know how to sing can turn that into something.
All right, I'm going to put this out there right now. If one of our listeners makes a basking shark breaching rap, we will post it on the Sharkpedia Twitter page. So for our listeners, that's your challenge this week. That's amazing. Okay, so what are some other theories that we can think of then? And it's funny, like I actually did an internship with the Alaska Whale Foundation studying humpback whales, and we had a lot of the same theories and saw the same things with humpbacks a while away breaching and almost simultaneously a humpback breaching right next to us. Almost like it did seem like they were trying to communicate. Obviously, that's very hard to prove. But what do you think about that, Alex? Are they communicating? I know they talked about that in this article as well.
Right. So I think in the animal kingdom, a lot of times when we think of whether they're communicating or whether this is some sort of like dominance display. And by that, I mean, one shark is trying to be the big guy in the area and show the others who's boss. We often see that when animals are competing for resources. Like, you know, there is a whale carcass. So you have the big great white coming in and all the other great whites kind of bail. So that's really common. But that doesn't, again, make sense for basking sharks, which is a little bit weird. So the other resource they could be competing for is mates, which I think Gore et al., the same paper, talks about. But what's interesting is that makes sense if there's a dominant sex that's breaching. And we usually assume that the males are the pursuers. They're smaller, right? They're going to have to go through the hard work of biting the female and figuring all that out. So for a long time, people thought that the breaching was also courtship, right? Trying these dominant males coming in and signaling their dominance to access the best females. But we see females breaching. So again, I love to think of this idea as a social cue, right? And it does kind of make sense. Again, very challenging. It would be super hard to prove this, but you see sharks coming together all in a big area. They're swimming in all these formations. They're associating with certain individuals. There are some times where they actually turn their bodies to follow other individuals. And then they're breaching at the same time. So for me, that indicates that there is certainly some sort of more complex, you know, individual signaling going on in these areas. And I think that's going to be very challenging to quantify or continue to study in basking sharks. But it's something that I hope people focus on because I think that could be really, really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the other cool things that they talked about in this paper that I want us to talk about is that if there were two basking sharks, the lead basking shark would breach and make, what did they call it? Like they would make this almost like vortex of water.
It was
water
like a pressure gradient or something. I don't remember gradient. The exact word, but I also found that interesting because I was like, is that what they right. use to follow each other in comparison to like a lateral line when fish are schooling? And is that right. like the primary sense that they're using to follow each other as opposed to any of the other senses that they have?
Well, right, but the thing they talked about in the paper is that the leading basking shark would breach and make that pressure difference, and then the following basking shark, as soon as it reached, like, physically reached that, like, pressure difference in the water where you could still kind of see the turbidity of the water from the first basking shark, as soon as the second one reached that point, it would also breach as soon as it hit that pressure gradient. What do you think about that, Alex? Because that, to me, was mind-blowing. Why would the second basking shark breach as it reaches that kind of turmoil of water?
Totally. And again, I think that lends more support to potentially this social signaling cue, right? Like the one in front of you did it, so maybe that's the time to do it. Another thing that's been discussed in basking sharks is what we call social learning. So where juveniles might learn the best places to be from the adults. Now, from what I saw in this paper, there did not seem to be a significant difference or effect of size in terms of who was following who. So when I read that, I immediately thought, oh, maybe it's not juveniles following males and or following adults. And in fact, I don't know that they even saw any juveniles. They're very hard to see sometimes. Mm-hmm. They're very flighty from my experience. So for me, that just lends support to this idea that perhaps it's like that's their social cue to do it as the first one did. I can't really say whether that's actually the case. It could be something to do with a modified prey field as well, right? Like as the animal's dropping back in, maybe it mixes up the prey in a weird way, but I'm not sure why that would cause the second one to breach. So we don't know.
Yeah, and I think they actually mentioned in the paper as well that perhaps when they breach, it like basically disrupts the zooplankton that's around the first basking shark that breached, and the zooplankton is their prey, right? So when that first basking shark breaches, it makes this whole turbidity of zooplankton, and then the one behind them can potentially benefit from getting all that zooplankton that's now been stirred up and is perfectly in line when they're at the right or left of their flank. They can just basically take a mouthful of zooplankton, which, if that is true, that is truly like social behavior. Right? They're like sacrificing an energetic cost for one of their conspecifics or another one of the same species to allow the other individual to benefit from their cost, which is like, again, just mind-blowing that we could see this from fish because sharks are fish. So that's just incredible to be able to actually witness that.
I did also just want to say, you know, there's when we study social behavior in animals, there's like a few major mechanisms that we think that are driving this behavior. So it's not just like, you know, sharks see each other and all of a sudden they have a connection. No, there's like years of evolution leading up to this. And some of those mechanisms include things like access to resources, like food or mates. And so certainly it's not out of the realm of the current theory, the current field, to think that this is what's happening when these basking sharks get together, for sure.
It's so cool. I also just need to go off topic, off the basking shark, because one of the random facts from this paper about zooplankton that I was like, what the heck, is that copepods have apparently been observed to detect pressure changes associated with an approaching predator, which, one, I just think that is crazy, because you basically have evolved to develop a way to avoid being eaten on, like, a crazy physiological level.
As a and tiny then on top invertebrate.
Yeah.
A tiny little like, invertebrate.
What? And then a on top of that, they one. Can jump out of the way? I just, thinking of copepods launching themselves out of the way in this, like, also very viscous water for them, viscous being how hard it is, how hard the water is moving against them and how hard it is for them to withstand the how water feels to them, I guess. The easiest way to compare that right now would be for a basking shark. Water is not that viscous, meaning they can just move through it. They experience drag, but it is not hugely detrimental to them. Whereas for a copepod, a tiny little animal, the water is very hardly pushing against them. Much like if we were in like quicksand or just walking through sand, where we really experience how much effort we have to put in to walk or run on the beach. Whereas if you run on concrete, it's fine and you're just going and you don't feel as much of a drag. Anyway, I was just like, they jump, what?
I know, that is so incredible. And it's just like another cool thing that just like marine animals in general have so many adaptations to overcome predation and the just kind of harshness of the ocean itself. It's just so amazing. And a little tiny invertebrate that really doesn't live very long at all somehow detects this pressure change and like tries to escape last second. It's amazing.
Let me live longer.
Let me live a few more days. Which is true. Now, the other thing that I thought was super cool, that like one of the theories I was screaming in my head as I was reading this entire article, because they were saying, okay, so we don't think that following in this, we don't think that these aggregations are mating. We've officially, and they concluded that, I don't even think we said, but that they concluded that because they never actually saw mating behavior occur when they saw these aggregations. And because, as Alex said, all of these basking sharks are really shallow. If these aggregations were meant for mating, we would have seen mating at some point. Like, it is very likely that we would have seen it at some point. And they basically determined that these aggregations aren't from mating behavior. But why would they aggregate? Especially that echelon behavior that we were talking about before, where the second animal is following behind the first animal. And the thing that I was screaming in my head the whole time, the entire time, was, it's like birds. They're doing it because it's an energetic cost savings. Now, for the listeners that have no idea what I'm talking about, the reason that you see birds flying in a V shape is because birds actually take turns spending energy cutting through the pressure difference in the air as they're flying through. So the animal that's at the very point and in front of that entire flock of birds is taking on the most energetic cost of cutting through the air. And then every animal behind them to their flank is actually saving energetic cost because they're not having to make that initial cut through of the air. And they're actually getting some kind of airlift and hydrodynamic benefit of following the leader. So the whole time I was reading this paper, I just thought, they're following the leader. They're saving energy. Like, the animal behind the first one is just saving energy. Of course, like, that makes sense. They're big sharks. They're trying to filter feed. Why wouldn't they follow each other and filter feed and save some energy? What are your thoughts about that, Alex?
So it's interesting that you say that, because another thing in the same paragraph that I caught on to was that there are no published records of this close following behavior by the other two filter feeding shark species. Even though whale sharks, for example, are also known to kind of gather at these, you know, plankton hotspots in certain places. But I don't think that necessarily negates that theory. So something you should know about basking shark feeding, they're the only what we call obligate ram filter feeder. So what that means is that out of all the three filter feeding species of sharks, they're the only one that can't suction their food into their mouths. So when whale sharks are at the surface or megamouth sharks are feeding, they can like suck the water into their mouths. Basking sharks do not do this. So in order to get water into their mouths, they have to swim. So they expend a lot of energy swimming. Their mouths are open when they feed, and that just increases the drag, right? That cost of feeding so much, because it'd be like, you know, running with that parachute behind you, except for the parachute's in front for them. So when I was thinking about that, I was like, oh, for this species that actually might track a little bit because they feed slightly differently than the other two filter feeders.
Yes, that makes total sense. Is there a way that, like, how would we even test that to prove that, though? Can we? And also, I guess one of my other questions is, do we know which species of filter-feeding shark is more prehistoric? Is basking sharks more prehistoric than megamouth or whale sharks? Do we know?
I should know that, and I definitely need a fact check on this, but I think they all evolved independently, the filter-feeding species. I'm not sure which evolved first.
I will
fact check.
I'm not
totally sure that we know. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, Sharkies, I did some digging and did in fact find that the whale shark, the basking shark, and that megamouth shark, they all evolve separately. However, I could not find if we know if one evolved before the other. So if one of you out there happens to know that, let us know, and we'll update y'all later.
I think what we have started to do, it's really hard to measure energy expenditure. It's really hard to measure how much energy they're giving off, right? So we do have tags that can do that. But again, that's really challenging to put on the shark sometimes. Another thing people have been doing is looking at the densities of plankton in the water where the sharks are feeding. So it's important to understand that there's plankton throughout the world, right? It's found all throughout the surface oceans, but it's not distributed evenly. So in these areas where sharks are coming together, there are like micro patches of plankton. So actually what we see in basking sharks often is they're only feeding for like 30 seconds at a time before they swallow. Mm. It's not like they're just continuously opening their mouths all the time. And so what people started to do is say, okay, in these areas where we're seeing sharks feeding, how much plankton is in that area, like in that area? And I think that's a really good indicator of how much food that these sharks might need. How much food is it worth to open your mouth for?
Right. Totally.
Now I'm just thinking about the size of a shark's throat. Because I've never thought about the fact that, like, they swallow. It's not like it's just, like, going in through their body and, like, that's it. There has to be some, like, mechanism in there. And then I'm, like, thinking, is the throat of a filter-feeding shark, like, smaller than the throat of a carnivorous shark? You know? Like, is there a difference in size? And if so, like, what the heck does that look like?
This also requires a fact check, but I have heard anecdotally that like the basking shark throat is the size of a fist. So I do think that they have certainly smaller throats, right? They just kind of filter, right? They don't need to like swallow a massive seal or anything.
Okay, Sharkies, no amount of Googling or literature search gave me anything about the diameter of a basking shark throat. So if you happen to be one of those people out there that's worked closely with basking sharks or happen to be a unique person that's done a necropsy or something like that, go ahead and let us know. Do you happen to know the diameter of a basking shark throat? And we'll update all the sharkies on the pod. Okay, but Alex, do basking sharks actually swallow the water?
That's a really good question. So like basking sharks obviously do not have baleen in their mouths like whales do. But what they do have are these filaments that line their gills. And so when they're feeding, their gills are fully expanded. And actually in the cameras that we have on them, you can see when they're feeding because of this. So their gills are wide open and they catch the plankton on these mucus lined filaments inside of their gills. And then when they stop feeding, they close their gills and they can swallow.
Oh, that's so cool. Basking sharks are so cool. Well, that's super great. I think we've talked about most of the main findings from this article, which is breaching is not necessarily mating behavior. These aggregations are not necessarily mating behavior, but there's definitely some sort of social aspect that's going on that we still want to research. But I want to ask you, Alex, are there any other main takeaways that we should talk about before we kind of conclude the remainder of this article and what they found from this article?
You know, I don't think so. I would hope that I think we've covered a lot of these topics, and I realized that this is a really challenging system to work in, right? I've tried to work on it in like for 5 years. And right. I hope that future generations of scientists aren't deterred by the challenges and can pursue, you know, creative ways to understand what's going on here. But I think that I really like this paper because I think it flew under the radar a little bit, and I actually read it when I was in Ireland thinking about where the basking sharks were. So I thought it was a really cool paper to talk about today.
Yeah. Do you actually know the authors? I meant to ask that earlier.
I know of these authors. They're pretty well known in the basking shark world in the Northeast Atlantic, but I've never met them.
Got it. Oh, that's so awesome. Are you going back to Ireland? That's my last question.
I do not currently have plans to. So unfortunately, due to the pandemic last year, my field season was canceled. This year, my field season is canceled, but I am still very heavily involved in a bunch of projects over there, including with the Irish Basking Shark Group. So I plan to have basking sharks in my life for a very long time.
Oh, that's so awesome. I can't wait to keep following you and see what else you find. And I just can't wait to see you kind of conclude your PhD and find what you figure out with the temperature changes, especially with basking sharks and salmon and these animals that change just crazy temperature gradients.
Thank you so much, Alex, for coming on our podcast and talking with us about basking sharks, because as I'm sure you could see from Megan's face and mine the entire time we were talking, we are shook. And also, basking sharks are awesome and everybody should know what they are. So hopefully, to all the people who've been listening to this podcast, you just learned a whole bunch more about a species that definitely doesn't show up on things like Shark Week or get as much attention as some of the larger sharks that we all hear about all the time. And so I'm hoping that you've got some cool party facts that you can bring next time you go to a bar as like an intro line. You can be like, hey, did you know one, basking sharks are the second largest fish in the ocean, and also they breach.
Yeah, they do.
And mic drop.
Yeah. And Alex, where can all of our listeners continue to follow you so they can continue to follow your journey in researching basking sharks?
Totally. So I am very active on Twitter. You can find me at AGMCINTURF. So AG, my last name. I also have a website, which if you Google me, you can probably find, but it's alexandramcinturf@squarespace.com. And I've blogged actually a lot about my experiences studying this species in Ireland specifically.
Oh, that's great. I can't wait to keep following you.
So cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And hopefully we'll probably have you on again at some point, because I could definitely go another hour talking about basking sharks.
I totally second that 100%.
No, thank you both so much for having me. This has been so much fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, okay, sharkies, until next time, this has been Megan.
And Amani. Swim you later. I just wanted to say that one time. I just needed to say that. We can cut it. I just wanted to say it out loud.
We're not cutting.